Ladies and gentlemen, we come now to the 11th and last lecture of our fall series. And this makes it appropriate for me then to tell you that we have a very good program planned for the spring series. The first lecture will be given on January the 28th. And the speaker on that occasion will be Mr. Gordon Fairweather, the Chief Commissioner of the Canadian Human Rights Commission. And he will speak on the year of Orwell and human rights. Those of you who are members will receive a printed outline of the program in due course. Speaking of members, reminds me that I should remind you that we need your financial assistance always to put on the sort of program that we have, and that there are two ways in which you can do this. The first and normal step is to become a member. There are modest fees. There's a table outside that will arrange the matter for you. And the second step is that if you're feeling Christmas spirit in particular, you can make a good donation in addition to the membership. I suppose the third thing now is to say that since this is probably the last occasion since I'm speaking to you before the holiday season, I should wish you a happy holiday and say I look forward to seeing you in that ominous new year, 1984. It's a pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, who is now one of our distinguished professors at this university. Professor Rackman was educated in South Africa at the University of Witwatersrand. He did his first graduate degree there, and then he went to the University of London, where he got his PhD. And he liked it so much, and they liked him so much, that he stayed on there until 1982. In 1976, he became the Professor of Abnormal Psychology at the University of London and the director of their clinical training program. In 1982, we persuaded him to abandon London, and he came here as Professor of Psychology and the director of our clinical training program. He is a distinguished teacher and scholar, written numerous articles and some 12 books. One of the books I see is called Fair and Courage, and that sounds like a very good preparation for the lecture this evening. He's going to speak to us on Fair and Courage, and it gives me pleasure to call on him to do so now.
How does this clip on? That's it. Okay. That's mine.
Well, then.
That's Vancouver for you. Thank you very much for that introduction, ladies and gentlemen. I should just say that I came to London because it was too wet. And that, I think, will tell you how much trust you can place in my judgment. Tonight, I'll be talking about fear and courage, and it is a subject that I find particularly interesting. I think many psychologists are familiar with the subject of fear, because for the past 30 or 40 years it has taken quite a prominent place in research work, particularly among those people who have clinical interests. And it is pleasant to be able to say that during these past 40 years, we have, as a profession, accumulated a great deal of knowledge about the subject of fear. Our understanding of the phenomenon has certainly improved. And perhaps most important of all, from the practical side, our capacity to modify unwanted and excessive fears has increased enormously. And we are able to do nowadays many things that formerly we were unable to do, and a large number of patients and clients who are troubled by excessive fear have been helped and are in a position to be helped by these new methods. During the course of this talk, however, I'll spend more time talking about courage than about fear, even though fear, from a practical point of view, certainly is the more important subject, because fear is, of course, the central feature of the most important of the psychological disturbances that are called neuroses. So this is not to deny the practical importance and significance of fear, but rather to talk about courage because it is a subject that, relatively speaking, has been neglected by psychologists. And the starting point for the inquiries into courage that I'll be talking about is a clinical paradox, a paradox that was observed about 20 years ago as the new methods of treatment that I mentioned earlier came into widespread use. And the paradox is this, that these methods of treatment, broadly grouped as behavioral therapy, are particularly helpful in assisting people to overcome intense, excessive, unadaptive fear. And the curious thing about it is that the most effective method of treatment that has been developed so far is one that requires these people, these very fearful people, to engage repeatedly and for prolonged periods in courageous behavior. What they have to do in almost all cases is to come into contact with that very thing which frightens them most, the situation or the object or the person, and to stay engaged with that person or situation or object, whatever it is, for these lengthy periods, despite considerable discomfort, which eventually will dissipate, but there is a period during which the patient undergoing this treatment is in a state of considerable fear and associated discomfort. Well, despite all that, and despite the difficulties of it, what clinicians observed and continue to observe is that the great majority of people who have these excessive fears, when offered and provided a course of treatment of this kind, succeed in completing the course of treatment. They are asked to repeatedly engage these fearful objects. They do so on many occasions and for long periods until the fears are overcome. And it took a little while for the paradox to sink in, but there it is, that here you have people whose problem is precisely that they are troubled and indeed often overwhelmed by excessive fear. You then ask them to perform courageously and at request and for lengthy periods. And they do it. So one then is faced with the question of how it comes about that these, or how is it possible that people who are so fearful are capable, under the right circumstances and with the right incentive and guidance, of carrying out courageous behavior. And one is forced to think then about the nature of fearfulness and the nature of courage. If extremely fearful people are, in these circumstances, capable of courageous behavior, should we not then question our concepts of fear and courage and stop thinking about people as being either fearful or courageous, one or other of those, but instead saying, is it possible that all people, or at least the great majority of people, are capable of both, that we are all capable of experiencing intense fear? Similarly, we are all capable of carrying out courageous acts if the circumstances demand it and if the conditions allow it. So that to bring it down into summary form, we could say that instead of talking about courageous actors, one then begins to talk about courageous actions. And that implies that one has to think not so much about the actor, the particular person carrying out the action, but the circumstances in which the act is carried out and the events leading up to it. And the investigations or the studies that I'll be talking about address questions of that kind. Just to give the studies, the talk that I'm giving, some sort of form, I'm going to start off with a quotation from one of the Platonic theories. This is a remark made by, or rather a question, put by Socrates to two of the Greek generals when they're discussing the question of courage. And what Socrates asked was this. He said, suppose we set about determining the nature of courage, and in the second place, proceed to inquire how the young men may attain this quality by the help of study and pursuits. Tell me, if you can, what is courage? And he put that question to the two generals, and other people participated in it. It is, I think, one of the more disappointing of these exchanges, because the answer was not fully addressed or answered. And I think modern psychologists can do a little better, but not terribly much better than Socrates. In starting to think about courage, as I said earlier, psychologists have very little to contribute because it hasn't been a subject that has attracted their attention. On the other hand, philosophers from Socrates and earlier and since have considered the nature of courage, and there are many volumes of writings on that subject. In addition to that, of course, soldiers have of necessity to consider the nature of courage and indeed to attempt to answer the question put by Socrates in practical form as well as theoretical. How indeed do you train people to carry out hazardous, dangerous activities? So that if one sets out to investigate the nature of courage, it is not unreasonable to look towards military samples, soldiers of various kinds, for some guidance in determining what courage is and how it can be acquired, if indeed it can be acquired. I think there's very little doubt that it can be so acquired. Well, the starting point for us then, when we got interested in the nature of courage, was to approach the army, and the group that we selected, for a variety of reasons, most of which are really obvious, was the that branch of the army, those soldiers who are responsible for disposing of improvised explosive devices, commonly known as bomb disposal operators. And in the British Army, the bomb disposal operators fall under the command of the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, to some extent the Royal Medical Corps as well, but mainly the Ordnance Corps. And fortunately, we were able to obtain their excellent cooperation throughout this period of some 6 years, during which we studied the bomb disposal operators. We asked essentially four questions, really along the lines that I've read out in that quotation from Socrates. We wanted to know whether it is possible to determine what the nature of courageous behavior is, assuming from the beginning, and I think not unreasonably, that people who have to dispose of bombs, specifically planted bombs, are carrying out, by definition, acts of courage. Well, how do you select people to do this kind of work? That was the first question. Secondly, having selected people who might be suitable for this kind of work, how do you train them to carry out this extremely dangerous work? And I should just stop there to emphasize how dangerous it is. It is one of those very rare tasks faced by human beings in which a single major error is absolutely fatal. You never get a second chance. If you make a major error, that is your last. And there are few tasks to compare with that. In fact, I can't offhand think of any. Well, how do you train people to carry out these tasks? And they're highly skilled tasks, technical tasks, in a way that ensures their safety and, of course, deals successfully with the device. The third question we were interested in, the first two, then, just to recap, are how do you select people for these tasks? Secondly, how do you train them to do it? The third question was, having selected and trained them, how well do these people perform under operational conditions? When they're faced with a task, what actually happens? What does courageous behavior look like? In fact, is this really courageous behavior? So we studied their performance under operational conditions, or under combat conditions, as they sometimes refer to. And finally, arising out of these first three questions, we ended up asking a fourth question that we hadn't initially set ourselves, and that was whether it is possible to identify amongst this group of people carrying out these remarkable duties any who were especially courageous. Is there a group of people who are in some respect or other particularly well suited to carrying out this very dangerous set of activities? So those were the questions that we were interested in asking, and indeed we set about asking them and spent a number of years trying to find some of the answers to them. As far as selection is concerned, that was our first big surprise in this entire enterprise, that when we started to inquire into the very clever methods of selection which they use, we very soon found out that in fact there is very little or no selection at all. That people who are trained technicians in the Royal Ordnance Corps, and that's a 5-year training course, are all expected to carry out bomb disposal duties given the additional specialized training that is required in order to carry out that duty. But it is regarded as just one other duty of an ordnance technician. That was very surprising to us because we had assumed before getting into this subject that the tasks would be carried out by a very highly selected small group of people, people who had been chosen for some very special qualities that the Army had cleverly over the years identified, and that they could select people with accuracy and regularity. Well, it turned out that we were wrong in that assumption, and as I've just said, all technicians are expected to do it. I should add that in the course of our studies, we've asked the operators how many of them knew at the time they had entered the Ordnance Corps that they might at some stage in their career be required to dispose of bombs, and less than half knew that bomb disposal duties had anything at all to do with it. So there's very little in the way of self-selection going on at the early stages. Going into the Ordnance Corps is regarded as joining one branch of the military. Most of the people in the Corps come from military families with military traditions and so on, and they choose the Ordnance Corps in preference to other corps, if they do, for technical reasons, reasons of early or assured promotion and things like that, or that they're family members in that branch of the Army and so on. So that was very surprising. Having gained their technician certificate at the end of the 5 years, they incidentally they join the Ordnance Corps as what they call boy soldiers, that is usually at the age of 16, 17 or 18 in some cases, and they complete their initial training within the first 5 years, so that by the time they are ready to go in for the specialized training, they would be in the region of 22, 23, something like that. In most cases, they're allowed to do other work first for 2 or 3 years and then go into the specialized branch to get their training as bomb disposal operators when they're about 26 years of age. And at that stage, before they go into the specialized training, some selection processes are used. They are not terribly effective, as we discovered. They consist of a battery of psychological tests, most of which I would not care to defend in public. They are not particularly discriminating tests. And those tests were then followed by a psychiatric interview. And if the person passed the test and the psychiatric interview, he then went to the specialized training school where he had 6 months of specialized training. If he passed all of those tests, exams, and demonstrations, and so on, he was then put on the active register for bomb disposal work, and he might then be called upon to act in that capacity within with a 2 weeks' notice. So that was the training. I should just explain by way of background what is involved in this work. During the period 1970 to 1980, which is the one we covered for most of our studies, the bomb disposal operators working, this is in Northern Ireland, were called upon to deal with more than 30,000 explosive devices. At the worst periods, they were dealing with 4 and 5 devices per day. In the quiet periods, of course, it would have been considerably less than that. So they were kept very busy, and they dealt with an absolutely enormous number of bombs. During that same 10-year period, they had 17 fatalities, which, relative to the amount of work they were doing, is really a very, very small number indeed. And all of that, those facts and figures, and there are others, but those are the key figures, indicate beyond any doubt that they were performing their duties extremely competently. That for the most part, they were able to render safe these devices reasonably promptly and with very, very few injuries and fatalities. Of course, there was a great deal of property damage, there still is, but for the most part, they were able to keep the human casualties down to a very small number. So, if you take that as an index of the high competence of these operators, which I think one is entitled to do, then you have to say, going backwards, that the selection procedures certainly, although they are minimal, are well justified. The Army assumes that everybody who has had the normal ordnance training is capable of carrying out these very dangerous acts. And that is the important thing. Turns out they're right, that all of their trained people, with minor exceptions that I'll speak about in a minute, are indeed capable of carrying out these hazardous duties given specialized training. The exceptions are few in number. In the specialized training procedures and in the psychological and psychiatric interviews and all that, what little positive selection there is, the rejection rate over the 10-year period I'm referring to, there were over 200 operators concerned in our study. We did a statistical analysis of this. Less than 5% were rejected on any grounds. So, and that's a very, very small number. The overwhelming majority of ordnance technicians, once trained, were considered by the Army to be suitable, were given the specialized training, and as I've just told you, they performed extraordinarily well over a long period. So the assumption that all of these people, or almost all of them, are capable of carrying out these very difficult duties is borne out. I should say, too, that the duties themselves are more than just rash acts of courage. The actual disposal of the devices requires a combination of excellent judgment, a very high level of technical skill, and considerable calmness while you're doing it. So it is a mixture of judgment, knowledge, skill, and the right frame of mind, the right psychological state. Well, most of them were able to provide all of those necessary attributes and to use them effectively. Next, we looked at the nature of the training. Well, if the Army is right and that all of these people are indeed capable of carrying out such acts, how on earth do they get them to the point where very reasonable, normal, well-adjusted people will take such terrible risks and do it repeatedly just in the day's work, literally? Before going on to that, I should also have just told you that the results of the psychological test, which I think were not terribly interesting, but they did show that as a group, these were a very well-adjusted group of people, that there was very little evidence in any of them of emotional instability or anything, or psychological disturbance. There were some people like that, but not very many, and only a tiny minority were rejected during psychiatric interview. Well, as to the training itself, it consists of 6 months of theoretical training and demonstration, and then 3 months of intensive training dealing with devices. And they approximate as closely as they can to real-life situations. The people are required to dispose of real bombs, except that the charge is removed. If they make an error, a very loud siren sounds, and it is extremely disconcerting, and of course the significance of it is more than disconcerting. So the training is as close as it can get, as it can reasonably get, to real-life conditions. What we did was to examine groups of these bomb disposal operators before they went into the specialized training and then look at them again after they'd completed it. And what we found was that prior to undertaking, rather prior to completing the specialized training, their willingness to do the work was not very great. Their confidence in their ability to deal with this particular type of task was also rather low, in both cases in the region of about 30%. That they only had 30% confidence that they could do it, and their willingness to do it was in the region of about 25%. They also rated the dangerousness of these tasks pretty high at this stage, in the region of about 55%. Once they'd completed the training, however, their confidence in their ability to carry out the task had shot up to 80%. Their willingness to do it had gone up to 85%. But their rating of the dangerousness of the task had not altered. So even though they continued to recognize that this was very dangerous work to do, because, one presumes, because of their growth of confidence in their newly acquired skills, they now were willing to do it, they were confident that they could. The levels of confidence expressed by the people once they'd completed their training in England was very close to the level of confidence which we obtained from bomb disposal operators working in the field, who also had confidence levels of about 88%. After training, the operators had confidence levels of about 81-82%. So the training was very successful in bringing their level of confidence and willingness to carry out the duties up to the levels seen in operational bomb disposal squads. Well, that's fine. They seem to select well. They train them very well. The operators at the end of training seem to be very confident they can do it. What actually happens when they go out into field conditions? Well, here we carried out two studies, two separate groups of operators over different periods. And what we found here was that the great majority performed their task extremely well. There were some difficulties. There were some people who failed to some degree or other. In the first group of 20 operators, there were no serious failures. In the second group of 20, there was one person who came very close to a major breakdown and was a considerable risk to himself and others. But what was very striking was that we watched these people, observed them on a weekly basis throughout their tour of duty, which lasts 4 months for the most part, and their psychological state was remarkably unchanging, that their mood state was pretty stable, their levels of confidence, their competence, all these things were relatively unchanging. The next question is, were they very frightened when they did this work? And the answer to that is that the majority, let me put it in percentages, it would be about 75% of the operators in both groups, roughly speaking, expressed some fear while they were carrying out their bomb disposal duties on at least one occasion. Most of them reported such fear on several occasions. About 20% said they were very frightened on many occasions or throughout the tour of duty. And then there was a smaller group, just under 20%, who said that they had no fear of any significance at any time throughout the period of duty. So what seems to be the case is that their psychological state is pretty stable, but they do get frightened. The majority do experience fear at some time, some of them intense fear, but nevertheless perform competently in a way perhaps that is not unlike the way that the patients I referred to earlier on, the ones who are extremely frightened but nevertheless are able to carry out courageous acts. Some of these bomb disposal operators are able to perform their hazardous duties, to perform courageously, despite experiencing high levels of fear. The most common thing, though, is to experience fluctuating levels of fear. Then there's that smallish group of under 20% who said that they had little or no fear at any stage. And it is to that group that I now turn attention. As a result of those findings and others which I won't dwell on now, it seemed to us that it is possible to make a broad division between people who perform hazardous tasks despite their fear, and that would fit the definition of courage, that is to perform and persevere, especially in a hazardous task, despite fear. Secondly, there's the group who perform these hazardous duties and dangerous duties in the absence of fear, and that, I think, comes closest to what you would call fearless performance. Those are the two extremes. You can carry out these duties despite your discomfort or in the absence of discomfort. And for a variety of reasons, that kind of division has proved to be quite useful in a variety of ways. Then there's the bulk of the people who have fluctuating fear. It depends very much on the circumstances. In some conditions, they would with certain kinds of tasks, they would experience very little fear. And then perhaps on the very next task they're given, they have considerable fear. The determinants of that were really fairly straightforward in most cases. Where they came across a device that they had never encountered before, or that was found in very suspicious circumstances, or where they had to dismantle the device under very difficult conditions, surrounded by sniper fire and so on, that in those circumstances it was quite probable that they would experience fear. If it was what they would regard as what you would regard as an ordinary everyday bomb disposal task, they would experience very little fear and deal with it calmly and competently. So the most for most of these people, fear is experienced as a consequence of particular prevailing circumstances, especially where something unexpected happens or there is some measure of uncontrollability or unknowability about the hazardous task facing them. But then the other extremes are those who are frightened most of the time and those who are very rarely frightened. Turning to the ones who are fearless, is, I think, a rather interesting undertaking, because it turns out that we may indeed have touched on a smallish group of people who, even in this highly competent, skillful group of people, are separated out in some way, that they do really have very little fear, despite having to carry out these terrible tasks. What we then did was to make an analysis of all the people who, during the 10-year period, 1970 to 1980, had received awards for gallantry while performing these bomb disposal duties. It was a fairly high proportion of people in the Royal Ordnance Corps, because it is widely recognized that what they have to do is extremely dangerous and difficult. And what we found, we looked at the people, the decorated operators, as we call them. We looked at the results which they had turned in various tests and interviews and so on. And lo and behold, although in most respects they were like the others, that is, extremely stable and well-adjusted, contented people, on some measures, just on two of them, they were below even that the level of the highly competent, skillful operators. They had literally zero scores. These are tests of maladjustment and things of that kind. To get a zero score is almost unheard of. And the decorated people, almost all of them, had absolutely zero scores. What that means in everyday terms is that they had absolutely no physical complaints, no mental complaints of any kind. They felt mentally alert, they felt physically well almost all of the time. I should point out that these test results were obtained long before they carried out the acts for which they were given medals, that the tests were completed during the selection and pre-training period, and then some months, and in some cases years later, they were on a tour of duty and they carried out an act of conspicuous gallantry and received an award. So the information was sitting there in the files, and we found that these decorated people had shown some differences in, if you like, psychological profile long before the pertinent act was carried out. Well, with that as a suggestion, we then collected a group of decorated operators and compared their performance under stress with another group of equally competent, equally experienced bomb disposal operators who had not received decorations. I should say that whether you get a decoration or not is not entirely dependent on what you do. There are some chance factors involved, whether you're observed and how important the task was and so on. But notwithstanding those difficulties, we were able to collect together a group of decorated operators and a group of non-decorated operators. And they were asked to undergo a stress test, a psychological stress test, under laboratory conditions. And in all respects, the two groups were very similar. They reported very little discomfort, almost no fear, despite the fact that it is very stressful. And they had very low physiological reactions. By contrast, a group of ordinary soldiers and a group of civilians undergoing the same test reported considerable fear before the test, during the test. Many of them were quite shaken up by it. They had very marked physiological reactions. The bomb disposal operators, decorated and undecorated, showed very few of these signs. They went through the stress test extremely calmly. Moreover, the seven decorated operators were even less reactive than the competent decorators. That is to say, they showed almost no sign, no physiological signs of disturbance throughout the stress test. I've already said that psychologically they said they hadn't been troubled. They felt pretty calm throughout the whole thing. So it seemed as if here we had some consistent evidence pointing to the possibility that there is a small group of people who are particularly invulnerable to stress, and by virtue of that invulnerability, especially well suited to carrying out these dangerous tasks. That experiment was repeated, and it has given us the same result again, so we're pretty sure that there is this smallish group of people who are very strongly resistant to stress. And what is more, they are people who are resistant to stress, both in laboratory settings and, as it seems, under real-life dangerous conditions. Well, what does that tell us? it might seem as if some of the results which we were getting are, in some respects, contradictory. Because on the one hand, as I said at the beginning, it turns out that people who are extremely fearful in many circumstances, nevertheless, are capable of carrying out courageous acts when it is necessary and when they're called upon to do it. That fearful people are capable of performing courageously, and therefore it wouldn't make terribly good sense to talk about brave people and timid people, because the timid can be brave and the brave will experience fear. On the other hand, the most recent work or most recent findings we've had from the bomb disposal operators shows that there almost certainly is a smallish group of people who are particularly invulnerable. So the answer might be a double answer, really, that yes, it is true that, or very likely true, that most people, however fearful they might be in certain circumstances, in other circumstances, under the right incentive and the right conditions, will be capable of carrying out courageous acts. And it's not just these skillful, stress-resistant people who are capable of doing it. And along those lines, it is possible then to reinterpret quite a lot of the information that was collected during the Second World War on the effects of aerial bombardment on civilian populations. Many of you will know that prior to the outbreak of the war, the expectation was that if either side, either of the protagonists, took to aerial bombardment of civilian populations, that that might be an attack, or it's called an attack, that would bring about complete demoralization of the population and almost certainly lead to victory for the attacker and defeat for the attacked. In preparation for the expected bombardment of England, and especially in southeast England, the British authorities set up, prior to the outbreak of war, when it became obvious that war was inevitable, they set up special clinics for dealing with the victims of psychological victims of air raids, clinics that were set up to deal with the expected panic. And they set these up in various parts of southeast England and in the Midlands, and staffed them with psychiatrists and what psychologists there were, not very many of them, nurses and so on. And then in due course, the attacks began. And what they found was really rather remarkable, that the clinics were not used. For example, during the 3 months of the heaviest bombardment in the London area, in the southeast London region, which covers that part where the docks were and was heavily bombarded, the medical officer responsible for that area was Sir Henry Wilson, and he reported that the special clinics there had had only 2 cases to deal with. Moreover, it is clear from the general statistics gathered during and after the war that there was no increase in cases of anxiety or other neurotic disorders, despite being subjected to the most dangerous and frightening experiences, almost the most frightening that one could imagine. And it was not just the British population that showed this resilience. The same things turned out to have been true in Germany and in Japan and other countries where figures were collected. So people were, in these circumstances, far more resilient than had been expected. And why is it? Because if you look at the contemporary and theories of psychology dealing with fear, there is no theory, there is no psychological theory that was being put forward in 1940, just as there's no theory being put forward in 1983, which would lead you to predict that people who had been subjected to that kind of terror and that those kinds of injuries would remain so fear-free. All of the theories unquestionably would predict that under those circumstances, massive fear would develop, that most people would be affected, that they would develop fearful reactions and anxiety that would last for a very long time. They would not diminish easily, if at all. Well, none of those things happened. That people turned out to be considerably more resilient than the theories allowed. The theories predict far more fear than is observed. And that brings me back to the question of how it is that fearful people are capable in certain circumstances of behaving courageously. And I think what one has to say is that certainly there are individual differences, there are dispositions to timidity, if you will. There are some people who express and experience a wide range of fears. There are others who have very, very few fears at any stage. So there are these individual differences that one starts off with. They might well have a constitutional basis. It seems quite likely that they do. Over and above that, though, if people do develop fears, they or are in danger of so developing them, they can be trained, they can acquire the skills by their own efforts or through the efforts of other people helping them. They can acquire competences and skills that enable them to deal with those situations in a non-fearful way. You can learn to overcome most of your fears. Furthermore, there are certain situational demands or conditions that would enable people who are at other times fearful to perform courageously, if only for a limited time under special conditions. So it was that under these war conditions I was talking about earlier, about civilians under aerial bombardment, there are endless stories about people performing acts of great valor and repeatedly under these special conditions, even people who suffered from considerable anxiety at other times. And psychiatrists working in and psychologists working in these regions at the time frequently remarked on how some of their most anxious patients were, under these very special circumstances and conditions, able to perform extraordinarily well. Furthermore, and here's an example of virtue rewarded, they found that people who were required to carry out essential duties, fire watchers, ambulance men, policemen, things of that kind, had almost no breakdowns at all. That the medical officer for the fire service and the police service in London during that time actually remarked on the fact that neither he nor any of the people working with him had been called upon to give psychological treatment to any of the people working in their regions. And there's other evidence, some of it now confirmed in laboratory studies, showing that when people, even fearful people, are required to carry out tasks in the interests of other people, to help other people, that their own fear will be suppressed for a time and might even be eliminated. So there are these various factors which will determine whether one will perform courageously or fearfully. Coming back then to the quotation that I started out with, what might a modern psychologist say in reply to Socrates? The questions were, just to remind you, he said, supposing we set about determining the nature of courage, and in the second place proceed to inquire how the young men may attain this quality by the help of study and pursuits. Well, the answer to the first question, I haven't gone into in much detail. I think modern psychologists could give a partial answer to that. It would be in a form of jargon that Socrates would find totally unacceptable, but there would be a partial answer. And I won't go into the technicalities of it. I think it's the second point which is most interesting for our purposes, and that is it possible to help people attain this quality, as he called it. He called it this noble quality with the help of study and pursuits. And I think the answer almost certainly is yes, it is possible to teach people to perform courageously. One would have to rephrase the question for Socrates, and I think that's always the way of an academic. You never answer the question you're asked. You always have to rephrase it. And the rephrasing would be that it's not a quality, that people don't can be trained to perform courageously under certain specified conditions, and if the incentives are right and the support given him or her is appropriate, that they will then perform courageously. It is not a select little group of people only who can perform these acts. Most people can. But in addition to that, one can answer a question that Socrates didn't put, and that, of course, is the final arrow for the academic to answer the question. No one bothered to ask. And it is that there does seem to be a smallish group of people who are particularly resistant to stress and especially well suited to carrying out hazardous, dangerous tasks by virtue of their competence, their calmness, and their low reactivity under stress. If it proves possible, as I think it will be, to identify these people with some accuracy, it might be that they will be the people whom we increasingly will call upon to do some of the very nasty and difficult and dangerous things that unfortunately are part of our life today. I think that the procedures we have, the informal procedures we have for selecting and training these people, probably are pretty effective already, but we might be able to improve on them by following this line of inquiry. Thank you.
Respect,
I think not.
We'll now have some questions. The not speeches, just short, pithy questions. And one to start with, if you don't mind.
Is it possible that the chemical or biochemical base for courage or behavior?
Yes. it certainly is possible, but as far as human performance is concerned, we know next to nothing about it. One could hazard guesses about, oh, it's hard to talk about courageous performance in animals, that's another question, but fearless behavior in animals can be associated with certain biochemical states, yes.
Did you ask the invulnerable people why they were fearless? Would you repeat that question?
Sure. The question is whether we ask the invulnerable people why they were fearless. Well, we did, but we asked all of the people participating in the study how they were able to deal with the situations and what their reactions were and how they felt about it. I could talk about this at length, but I really won't. But I should say, though, that these people don't use the word fear, that they will describe it in all sorts of roundabout ways, but they don't use the word fear. So we did and found that didn't get very far, so we would use their language, which was some of the terms they used were the adrenaline got going and things like that, or I felt really hepped up, something of that sort. And most of them said, well, if you're really well trained and you do your job properly and follow standard operating procedures, you should not be frightened because it's not that dangerous. Although their ratings of danger are pretty high, they say, given the right training skills and if you use your judgment, it's not dangerous, and that's the way to ensure that you shouldn't, that you don't get frightened. Sometimes things go wrong, and they would attribute fear when they experienced it, this is not the invulnerables, the others, to things, to unexpected things happening, or equipment failing, things, perfectly reasonable things. But the invulnerables would say, I don't know, I just don't have it. I also had a very interesting interview with a man called Henry Cooper, who was for a number of years the heavyweight boxing champion of Europe, and had a long, bruising career and got really badly knocked about in his time, including by Muhammad Ali. And I I spoke to him about his fear, and I asked him whether he'd ever been frightened, taking all that punishment and pain and so on. And he was a remarkably frank and honest person, and he said he had never experienced fear in his life, not during the fights, not before the fights, not at any time. He admitted to a mild amount of fear about driving on a motorway, but not too much. And I'm absolutely certain he was not trying to dissimulate. He was trying to be as frank as he could. And he said, I know what it is because I've seen it in other people, and my wife is very frightened. For example, she won't watch a scary television film unless I'm at home. But I don't feel it, and I've never felt it. I remember as a youngster, even age of 12, walking through a very frightening part of the city, and I never experienced fear. I just don't know personally what it is. I know it exists, and I can recognize it in other people. In fact, some of the people he had boxed were frightened, and he knew it. But he personally had never had it. Sorry, lengthy answer to your question. Yeah.
Is it possible to give a composition picture of some word picture of the type of person who is fearless? Are they the jock type? Are they the unimaginative type? Are they the non-artist?
Yes, the question is whether it's possible to give some sort of composite picture of the people who are the rent of the invulnerable ones. I can try it, but at risk of oversimplifying, because in all we're dealing with less than 30 people. But they're remarkably well adjusted, the ones we were dealing with. As I said earlier, the decorated ones are amazingly well adjusted. They have almost zero scores on almost all tests of maladjustment. They are almost all very active, physically active, fit people, mentally alert, certainly. They take pride in their physical and mental condition. Almost all of them are taking courses in one thing or the other, continuing to improve their education, even though they were very skilled already. They had a very high regard for duty and all felt that what they were doing was important. Incidentally, very few of the bomb disposal operators expressed any kind of bitterness or anger towards the opposition. They were the opposition. But they didn't express personal anger towards them. They struck me as being a remarkably well-adjusted group of people. I really can't say because we didn't go into that. I'm trying to think as I stand here whether any of them mentioned artistic interests, and I can't offhand. There was one whose wife was a painter, and he quite liked her work, but he didn't paint or anything. But I really can't answer that question. I don't know. What I can say is that they were not sensation-seeking. Dr. Cox, who formerly was of UBC, is now at Simon Fraser, helped in some of this work, and he carried out an investigation of these people to find out if they were what's called in the jargon sensation-seeking, whether they were people who liked and actually sought out highly stimulating or dangerous conditions, and they're not. They're average. They're not high sensation-seeking. They're not antisocial either. That's another question that is often asked. They don't carry out any illegal acts, and they have no interest in doing it at all. They're not at all antisocial. Quite the contrary.
Yeah.
Is it possible that people who have, say, a lack in their body of vitamins or minerals, that they are more exposed to fear if anybody ever pinpointed down?
No, there's a lot of speculation about what might be at the base of it, but it is really in the realm of speculation, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Would you glance at by claustrophobia as a form of fear?
The question is claustrophobia a form of fear? Yes, that is the definition, is it's intense fear of enclosed spaces. Yeah. Absolutely. And incidentally, claustrophobic patients, many of them, will respond to these retraining methods that I was talking about, and it would consist, in most cases, of encouraging them gradually to spend more and more time in enclosed, cramped conditions. So they have to do precisely the thing which evokes the most fear. And that is what is so interesting, so amazing, that when you ask them to do it under the right clinical conditions, and with the right support, almost all of them will do it repeatedly and for long periods. It's amazing.
Question, Carol?
You spoke about incentives and support as requisites for the performance of courageous acts. In your opinion, might there be any relationship between the loss of absence of those and the high incidence of post-traumatic stress disorders in Vietnam veterans?
That's really two questions. If I could just try to repeat them. The question is whether the importance of incentives in promoting courageous acts might go some way towards explaining what happened in Vietnam. I think the explanation for what happened in Vietnam, if I had it, which I don't, would be more complex than that. But there is an interesting sidelight on psychological state of American troops in Vietnam. There was quite a large study carried out amongst American troops in Vietnam before the whole thing got completely out of hand in the very early stages. And what is so amazing is that they recorded the lowest ever rate of psychological abnormality in any group of American troops anywhere. And that book was published. By the time it came out, things had gone terribly wrong. And you had what was perhaps the worst period from that point of view in American military history. So it wasn't like that from the beginning. What accounts for it, I think, really, you would need a political, social, military historian to explain. I really think that it would be wrong of me to have a stab at that. I think it's outside my competence, really.
Mrs. Lett.
But the perfect example has on promoting courage or fear.
What example would, what effect would an example have on promoting courage? As it turns out, it's extremely important. It forms the basis of most of the techniques I was talking about, where you start off by having someone demonstrate comparatively fearless behavior, and then the fearful person imitates it. And courageous models are extremely powerful. But it can go the other way. You get what's called in military circles fear by contagion. And if in a group of soldiers one or two people display intense fear, that can just ripple right through the whole group. So you can get people imitating courageous behavior, very importantly. You can also get people imitating fearful behavior, and you have, if you're engaged in some duty where there are groups of people, you have to be very careful that your courageous model doesn't go wrong, because it might backfire. But the behavior of other people is tremendously important in determining courageous performance. Very important indeed.
Could the case be made the other way around, that courage is the normal thing and fear is the abnormal? I'm thinking of the people who some stories up in the air, weld steel, and not have even time to munch sandwiches out there. Do they perhaps think they are the normal ones, and all we were afraid of it, something wrong with us?
The question is whether courageous performance is the norm and fearful behavior is the abnormality. Well, as a start, I think their sandwiches are probably better than mine. I wouldn't have sandwiches at any height. I don't think that one can answer it in that terms, honestly. I think that in certain circumstances, fearful experience of fearful behavior is highly adaptive and normal in the sense of being adaptive. And that someone who is widely, universally fearless might well get into difficulty. And equally that unthinking courageous behavior is potentially unadaptive too. I don't think you can make a division along those lines. Of course, if you're dealing with extreme cases, you can say that yes, excessive fear where it's inappropriate is the abnormal state, as in clinical conditions, that is, they are by definition abnormal. But there are many circumstances in which fear is appropriate and adaptive, and where courageous performance might not be so.
Yes.
Many of us are fearful or anxious for the welfare or safety of another person. Do you think that the people you describe who don't experience fear are oblivious in this kind of way?
Yeah. The question is whether, well, starting off from the observation that most people are concerned and often apprehensive about the welfare of other people. And do the fearless ones, the relatively invulnerable people, show such apprehension? Yes, they do. These people spoke at length about their concern for their fellow soldiers. They spoke at length about their concerns for their family and their wives and children and so on. No, they had normal social concerns, but I think that would be a rather different kind of fear, a different level of fear than the intense, acute, sharp fear that I've been talking about. General anxiety or concern, rather, about other people, that's they're no strangers to that.
You had some interesting things to say about claustrophobia, and agoraphobia would be much the same sort of thing, but the element of danger is not really present. I know I've suffered very seriously from acrophobia, and there is a real element of danger in climbing to a great height and so forth. Would your remarks hold true for that type of problem?
The question is whether the remarks about excessive fear would apply to acrophobia as equally as it does to, say, agoraphobia or claustrophobia. Well, it depends. Yes, it depends very much on your definition. I think a certain amount of fear in high places, particularly if they're unguarded, is adaptive and appropriate, as I was saying earlier on. What we're talking about here in clinical conditions, though, is excessive fear, which is unadaptive. So someone who can't go up to, and there are many such people, who can't go up to the third or fourth floor, even if it's well protected, they get extremely anxious, sweat, and have palpitations and dry mouth and so on, have fear, acute fear of a kind that is disabling. That is abnormal in the sense of being unadaptive and excessive. But chewing your sandwiches, as the earlier questioner used as an example, chewing your sandwiches on 50 stories up, I'm not sure that that's really adaptive, excessively adaptive. But I understand that there are people who work in these high buildings who are relatively fearless. They might be worth looking at, actually, finding out whether they have some similarity to the people I've been talking about. But it's a matter of how intense it is and whether it's disabling and adaptive. But really, not all fear is unadaptive. and unwarranted. Some fear is highly adaptive.
There's a question over here.
We didn't look at it. The question is whether there were differences in the belief systems of the fearful and fearless groups. We didn't look at it in terms of religion, but they did answer questionnaires on value systems and so on. There were no differences there. But let it be said, these are not highly subtle, deep tests. They measure fairly superficial attitudes, but there were no differences on those between the groups.
The acts of courage that you described, protecting people, saving lives, by your definition, might there be courage involved in someone skydiving, overcoming a fear?
Yes. I think the question is whether skydiving might also be construed as courageous in certain circumstances. Yes, I think it would fit into the definition, at least the definition I use, which is that courage, or courageous behavior rather, is the performance of some difficult or hazardous or outright dangerous task despite feelings of fear and discomfort. That is courageous. If you're a skydiver and you jump out of the aircraft and float through the air and you have no fear, no discomfort, that is a fearless performance, not a courageous one. And that's the distinction that is made. So it depends on, the classification in the end depends upon subjective report, subjective feeling, while the hazardous task is being carried out.
Question over here.
Would you say that fear and nuclear annihilation is normal or abnormal today?
I think if I answer that, that would be a rash act. I can't answer that.
Question here.
Are the sensations of fear similar in everyone? And if so, what are they?
They're not identical, but there are certain common elements which you would get in most fear reactions in most people, but the patterning is slightly different. It's customary to divide them into three groups. There's the subjective reaction, that is, I am frightened, I am apprehensive, and that is scaled in a standardized way for psychological purposes, but the variations, the subtle variations, are really quite large. Physiologically, there's not a great deal of variation between people. The typical signs are tachycardia, perspiration, tremor, extreme levels of muscle tension. And the third element is what is called fear behavior, usually taking the form of acute avoidance behavior. That which we fear, we tend to avoid most often. That you flee, but in some cases you feel paralyzed and can't move, you become immobilized. But most often the behavior that is associated with it is to flee or avoid, escape if you can. So it's those three elements, the subjective apprehension, anticipation of something horrible, a set of physiological reactions I've described, and a tendency to escape or avoid, quite urgent tendency in many cases, say in the examples we've given, claustrophobia, agoraphobia, and so on. The person affected wants to avoid getting into that situation. If he can't, he'll escape the earliest possible moment. So people like that would want to sit in a well-lighted hall, and they'd like to sit near the exit or on the aisle and things of that kind.
You did one more question from here, yes.
I was very interested to hear the topic of your lecture, because a lot of the young people that I speak to
question about the possibility of nuclear war. And many people say, well, you know, what can I do? And what would you suggest as a valid answer for these people? It's very difficult.
I really, the question is what advice one could give to people who are frightened of nuclear war. It is, of course, a rational fear, I mean, rationally based. I don't know that I'm in any better position than you are to advise them what to do. I don't think it is, for most people, an unadaptive fear. I think if it led to immobilization or something like that, or the person's life was affected in a way that is out of proportion to what can be done. I think that might be a problem, but to have some level of fear, I think, is rational and indeed adaptive. I think anyone who had no fear of the possibility of nuclear war has not thought of it, or is defective in some other sense, but a rational fear of it, I think, is appropriate.
I was really asking about particular ways of trying to cope with that fear and avoiding it.
Unfortunately, it's not one of those things that one can avoid. This is the thing. There is. At the level of a single person, a single citizen, there is not a great deal that can be done except by indirect methods, very slow indirect methods. But it does not become the sort of problem I could have anything to say about unless it reaches an absolutely irrational, excessive level of a kind that is damaging to the person in a way that is not damaging to all of his fellows. You know, then I might have something useful to add, but in general, I'm in no better position to advise than you are.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay.
I'll call on Dr. Peter Sutfeld, the head of our Department of Psychology, to express our thanks.
Thank you. Well, on behalf of the Institute, I would like to thank Dr. Rackman for an enlightening and interesting talk. As a psychologist, I would also like to thank him for countering two common criticisms that people make of psychology. One is that psychologists always concentrate on people's weaknesses and shortcomings and ignore their strengths and admirable characteristics. I think that this talk was one that certainly emphasized not only the admirable characteristics that a small proportion of people have, but the heights to which almost anybody can rise. The second criticism is that psychology, being the science that studies white rats and university sophomores, is not relevant to human beings. And I think that this talk gave us not only an understanding of a wide range of behaviors other than those that are found in the laboratory and on university campuses, but it also gives this audience a special insight with which they can watch, either in person or on television, the gladiatorial contest that will take place tomorrow. Thank you.